to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. During the recent SpaceX Dragon Demo 2 launch, I got to know a fellow journalist and truly a kindred spirit, Brendan Byrne. Brendan covers the spaceflight beat for WMFE, the NPR station in Orlando, Florida. His podcast, Are We There Yet?, is an engaging way to keep track of what's going on along the space coast, eastern Florida, surrounding the historic and recently revitalized Kennedy Space Center. I reached out to Brendan and asked him if he'd like to collaborate, me on his show and he on mine. What you're about to hear is that conversation that I thoroughly enjoyed, and I hope you will too, as we look in depth at America's place in space, past, present, and future. And one note of apology, I did confuse the two astronaut twins, Mark and Scott Kelly. Brendan interviewed Scott, who spent nearly a year in space aboard the International Space Station from March 2015 to 2016. Mark is one of my personal heroes, the husband of former U.S. Representative Gabrielle Giffords from Arizona. He's now running for Senate there, and while I got them mixed up for a moment here, I bet their mom did at least once. I donated $5 to Mark's campaign to atone for my mistake. So without further ado, let's introduce ourselves and get on with the show. I am Dave Schloem, host of Blue Dot in Northern California.
And I'm Brendan Byrne. I host Are We There Yet?
And where's Are We There Yet based at, Brendan?
It's everywhere. No, it's based out of Orlando, Florida, is where the station WMFE is, which, Dave, as I'm sure you know, is just a few dozen miles away from the Kennedy Space Center. So we are right near the threshold of space exploration here in Florida.
The fabled Space Coast.
Yep.
Yeah, and of course, Blue Dot is also distributed nationally, so we're both everywhere, and of course, podcasted wherever you get your podcast groove on, as I like to say. I'd like to start out asking you a couple of questions about how you got interested in space.
Sure.
What generated that interest for you?
Oh, well, when I was a kid, my dad was very interested in space, and I grew up in Broward County, which is in South Florida, and there was a chance for us to go on a field trip to the Kennedy Space Center. And at the time, they had an astronaut, almost like a space camp for young students. And my dad was really interested in it, and I wasn't, but my dad couldn't go as a chaperone unless he had a kid to take. So he kind of forced me to go so that he could experience space camp. And from there, just kind of fell in love with it. And, that was in, I think it was in fifth grade at the time, and, decided that, I would pursue that as a career. I wanted to be an astronaut. And then I got to middle school and I met algebra and realized that I probably wasn't going to be, anywhere close to going to space with my complete lack of understanding of mathematics. So I chose a different career path. And I ended up working in public radio after college, and this was in 2013, 2014. So this is a few years after the space shuttle program had ended, and a few more years before the kind of the resurgence here on the space coast. So we used to have a space reporter at WMFE, and then after shuttle, we didn't anymore. And we were deciding that, we were going to restart the beat, at the station, and my news director asked who wanted to do it, and I raised my hand and said I'd be interested in doing it. She said, well, okay, what's your qualification? And I said, well, I went to space camp in fifth grade, and she said, all right, you're in. And that's how I became the space reporter at WMFE. So it dated back quite a few years, and I'm happy to be able to lend a hand to space exploration, although I'm not doing the math. I'm telling the stories, and I think that's an equally important job of exploration.
Sure it is. And if you're interested, I'll tell you my origin
story.
Yeah,
how did you get into this?
it's a similar yet different, because I'm quite a bit older than you are. I'm 60. And when I was 7, got doggy action.
Sorry, yes. One of the joys of working from home.
Yeah, no, I have them too. So I know the dog drill was just, you do the canine restart.
Yes.
So when When I was seven, I had had one of those childhood diseases. I think it was the mumps or something like that. And I was kind of bedridden, stuck inside for an extended period of time. And it was right at the height of the Gemini missions. And I call them Gemini because I'm an astronomy guy. And if you talk to the old hands, they call it Gemini.
Gemini.
Yeah. So either way is fine with me, but I'll stick with Gemini because it's the way we pronounce the constellation. If I'm talking to
You can deal with the angry emails you're going to get now, Dave.
I have so many friends from that era that actually, I have a friend that flew on a Gemini mission. I just go back and forth. So anyway, my story is I was stuck inside and the missions were on television. And so I started watching them. There was nothing else to watch. It was either that or, old movies. And I just became enthralled. And I went to the public library and I got every book I could find on space. And I ran into the Collier's articles by Wernher von Braun and started reading those. I remember a book by Willy Ley, who was also a German from that time, and I just started reading everything I get my hands on. And then in 1967, I went to visit my sister, who was living on a boat in Daytona Beach, Florida, and she knew of my interest, and she said, well, we're going to take you to the Kennedy Space Center. And I was, unlike you, this was not a blind date my dad forced me on to go out with space. I was very excited. And so I went on the trip and, in 1967, KSC was, virtually brand new. Everything was, they hadn't even flown they had flown a Saturn V, I believe, the first test. No, they hadn't flown a Saturn V yet. They were just, starting to put things together. The VAB was brand spanking new. So it was just stunning to see it all. And, and I remember seeing the Mercury 7, monument there. And this was right after the fire that killed, Gus Grissom and Roger Chaffee and Ed White. And I knew about that. I was quite aware of it. And I remember that staring at that monument, like it was, a memorial kind of thing. And I started crying and the tour guide, had to kind of comfort me and say, it's okay. And then we went on the tour. And then I don't remember if this is true or not. My sister swears it is. It could be apocryphal. The rest of the tour, she said, a lot of times if the bus driver, the tour driver made a mistake, like about which pad it was or what flight took off there, whatever, I would correct the guy. This little precocious 7-year-old, an annoying kid, I guess. And the guy was very good humored about it and says, oh, you're right. And then after the bus ride, he said, son, you should come to work here someday. And I said, oh, I'd love to do that. So kind of like you, I ran into the math problem in junior high school. And I think mine was because I fell in love with my 8th grade math teacher. And I was spending way too much time staring at her beautifulness and not looking at the beautiful equations on the board. But later on in life, I rediscovered that I could do math, and I became a physics teacher. And I love math now. It's interesting because when I heard your story, it sounded very familiar. The other thing I'd like to share with you is, let me ask you this question. What's the one question, because you've interviewed a lot of astronauts on your program, and I enjoyed your, especially your interviews with Mark Kelly and Chris Hadfield. Mm-hmm. What's the question astronauts get asked the most?
What's it like to go to the bathroom in space? Hands down, that's the...
yeah, okay. Yeah, they do get asked that. That's usually the one that comes after though. There's one they get asked all the time. And it's, what do you tell a kid who wants to be
wants
to grow up like you? Yeah. How do you become an astronaut? What's your advice? They get asked that all the time. And they always have an answer that, has to do with, you want to be, good at STEM, you want to study math and you want to be good at science, but you want to follow your passion and be a well-rounded person, find something that's interesting to you. And the point of that is your chances of being an astronaut are very, very small. It's not impossible because there are astronauts, But it's not, you know, not very many people. It's the creme de la creme that make it to be an astronaut. But you want to find something that you love, that you enjoy doing, so that if you don't get to be an astronaut, you're still doing something that you really enjoy. You always hear that answer, and I think it's a great answer. But what I like to point out to people is there is a lot of different ways to contribute to the exploration of space, just like what you do, if, for example. But there, you know, there are people working at SpaceX designing those rockets and, you know, and actually manufacturing and working on them, or spacesuits. There's so many jobs that are related to space exploration that are, you know, very rewarding to go to. When you talk to the people that worked on the Apollo program or the shuttle program, and I run into them all the time. You know, my uncle, you know, worked on the space shuttle engines at Aerojet or someplace like that. They're so proud of their uncle or their grandfather, and and they're proud of them because those people were proud of what they did. And I'm starting to see a resurgence of that. Are you?
Oh, absolutely. To your point, around the Apollo 50th anniversary, Kennedy Space Center hosted a press day to kind of go around and see some of the sites and talk to the people that worked on Apollo. And there's a guy that if folks watch any of the recent webcasts from NASA, they'll recognize him, Daryl Nail. He was a reporter here on the Space Coast, and then switched over to work for NASA Public Affairs. He does a lot of their broadcasting there. Well, he was there, and one of the people that we met was his uncle, who worked on stacking the Apollo in the VAB. And to see these multi-generations of you know, NASA workers, and to your point, in very different sectors of the space industry. You know, you had a guy, you know, building the rockets, and then, you know, his nephew who is, you know, counting down the launches of these rockets. Both very important jobs, but they were both very proud of each other. And it's very, we're getting to a time now where we're seeing the next generation of these people that you know, have relatives that worked at NASA. They have folks that worked for, you know, Lockheed Martin and Boeing and some of the other legacy companies. Their kids are now getting into it, and it might not be the things that they were doing. It might be in communication, or it might be in the legal side of things, or accounting. But it's a multi-generational thing, and it's really cool to see that.
Yeah, and I have a question for you. As somebody that was working there on the Space Coast right after the shuttle program ended, I know for myself, that was a real bittersweet moment, seeing Atlantis come back to Earth and knowing we had no launch capability ready to go. And we've been through that before with the end of the Apollo program until the startup of shuttle. But we had the shuttle in the pipeline. And at the time that Atlantis ended, things were a little more, you know, up in the air, shall we say. You know, we had the two the contractors, the private contractors, and the commercial use of space agreement going on. But, you know, we didn't really know what that was going to look like. And it was kind of depressing. I'm wondering, what was it like covering space flight for you during those years before this year?
So I took over the Space Beat in 2015. So this is about 4 years removed from the STS-135, the last flight of Atlantis. And I was a student when Atlantis had its last mission. But I will tell you, it was taking over the Beat in 2015. It was a tough sell to our listeners and the people around me when I said, oh, yeah, I'm covering space. And like, well, why? We don't you're not doing anything. Like, the shuttle's canceled. There's nothing going on. And in 2015, there was, I think it was actually 2014. It was my first assignment as the space reporter was the launch of OFT-1, which is the operational flight test of the Orion space capsule. And this was a huge, huge mission. And there really wasn't that much excitement. So it kind of was my job at the start of it to kind of sell to our community and sell to our listeners that, hey, that this is important. There's things happening. So much really interesting missions were launched between 2015 and, you know, Commercial Crew, which you alluded to. You know, we had the launch of OSIRIS-REx. We've had the launch of TESS. All these cool things that are happening right in our backyard, and folks didn't know it was happening. So I think that was important to see that there were there were space reporters reporting on this and telling these stories. And you start to see, like, I look at to my friends at Florida Today, which is the newspaper in Brevard County. And when I first took over this beat, there was, you know, one reporter. Now there's a group of three reporters and two photographers at every launch. And it's so great to see that there's so much more interest in this now. But to your original question, it was quite depressing to kind of report on this beat after shuttle. It was really difficult to get people interested in space exploration.
We're going to take a short break. You are listening to me, Dave Shlom, host of Blue Dot, and Brendan Byrne. He is the host of Are We There Yet, the podcast from WMFE in Orlando, Florida. Stay with us as we talk about the state of spaceflight in America. And we're back. I'm Dave Shlom, host of Blue Dot from NSPR in Northern California, and he's Brendan Byrne, host of Are We There Yet? From WMFE in Orlando, Florida. Let's return now to our conversation about America's place in space, past, present, and future.
What's been your experience, you know, covering covering space, you know, for the past 4 years?
Well,
Or nine.
Yeah,
sorry, it's been nine years.
You have to realize that my show is not just about space. My show is much more broader in scope. I cover the geosciences, climate change. So I always have all kinds of interesting guests to talk to. But to your point, when I first got started, I did a lot of stuff with the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, because robotic exploration has been going great guns out to Mars, mm-hmm. with the rovers.
Oh,
you
yeah.
know.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, I hit it where, you know, we had just discovered the geysers on Enceladus. And my first interview was Gentry Lee. Do you know who he is?
No.
Legendary engineer from NASA JPL. He was Carl Sagan's good friend, one of the people that helped create the Cosmos TV series.
How cool.
So yeah, he's just an amazing man. And he was my very first guest. And it was, you know, I still look back at it and think, you know, how did I manage to get him as my first guest? It was just a miracle. Anyway, I remember Gentry, who was just this eloquent person. He was quoting poetry by T.S. Eliot and things like that to me, and just amazing to listen to him talking about how he teaches his students. But he mentioned to me, he's like, well, when I'm teaching a young engineer, how are you going to design a mission to fly through the geysers of Enceladus and capture what the material is and bring it back or analyze it? You know, how would you go about doing that? And when I heard that, I thought to myself, geysers, Enceladus has geysers? And I didn't even know. It was just because it was a brand new discovery. So I happened to hit it where, you know, Cassini was going, you know, great guns, and I got to interview Carolyn Porco and a lot of the Linda Spilker, some of the top Cassini scientists, and a lot of the people involved, Steve Squires with the Mars Rovers, Spirit and Opportunity. So I had all these wonderful guests exploring, you know, the solar system. And LRO at the moon, which, and the moon's always been one of my passions because, you know, I grew up with the Apollo program, and, you know, that's kind of the thing that generated the interest for me. So I have not had that depressing, you know, thing that you had on the Space Coast. At the same time, I was fully aware that there were no crewed launches happening from American soil at, you know, the hallowed ground of the Kennedy Space Center, and that launch, you know, complex 39 Alpha was just sitting there and decaying. There is a great documentary. Did you see Last Man on the Moon about Gene Cernan?
I did when it first came out, yeah. Which is a while ago.
Yeah, wonderful.
Yes, it was great. It was great.
Wonderful documentary. Yeah. And there's a scene there where he walks out to the pad, you know, and he sees the condition it's in. And he's just, he says something to the effect that I wished I hadn't even come out here. And it's depressing. So with that as our backdrop, let's talk about now, because, you know, what a turnaround. Now that same place has this beautiful gleaming launch structure that looks like something out of the movie 2001: A Space Odyssey.
Right.
You know, and we just had this launch. So I'd like to ask you, tell me about your experience with the recent launch of the Dragon Demo 2 mission.
It was incredible, and this has been something that has been on the top of my mind for since I took over this beat. That, you know, the reason why we are, you know, directing resources to cover this beat is because eventually we're going to have humans launching from the Kennedy Space Center once again. And that is going to be such a big story. And so I have been thinking about this story for, you know, the 4 or 5 years that I've been on this beat. So for it to actually come together was just incredible. And I'll share this story with you, Dave. As a journalist, you at least I myself find myself doing this, is you try to distance yourself from the story. You try to not have any emotional connection to it so that you can let the story have the feelings and all that. And I did a profile for NPR on Doug Hurley. And so, you know, I know this guy in and out, talked to some of his colleagues that were in his astronaut class with him, you know, heard from his family and did this piece on him. And, but it was that moment when I was at the press site and the Teslas were driving Bob and Doug to the launch pad on Saturday before they launched. And I walked down. There weren't very many press there because of COVID-19. So I was able to walk down pretty much to the road. And I saw the Teslas coming through. And the second car contained Bob and Doug. And Doug Hurley was on the side facing me, had his window down, he had his visor up, and he waved, and gave me a thumbs up, and I could see his face. And until then, he had just been a biography on NASA.gov. He had just been, you know, a portrait in his space helmet. But at that moment, I saw that he was a real human and a real person, and that's when all those emotions that I tried to, you know, to stifle, to tell this story, came. And it was this really incredible moment of realizing just the gravity of this story and the gravity of this moment, that these were actual human beings that were being launched. And it was emotional, because that was the day that they did launch. And it was just absolutely incredible to see and to be there for that moment. And I am truly lucky to be able to be there and be responsible for telling that story. And I realized the gravity of that responsibility, but it was just an absolutely incredible moment to bear witness to this next chapter of human space exploration.
Yeah. And so tell me about what it was like for you Wednesday and then Saturday.
Wednesday, Wednesday, I knew it wasn't happening. You just kind of, you get a feeling.
I did too. I have a very good friend who's a weatherman in Huntsville, Alabama. And he's a space nerd like us. And he's just a brilliant meteorologist on television there. And he texted me that morning, says, they're not launching today. And he sent me, you know, all the computer models. And he said, there's just no way. And I'm like, okay. Because we knew, you know, they have to launch at a specific moment. It's not like the shuttle where you've got a window, really. That rocket just doesn't have the power to do that right now. So,
yeah.
So, you know, you just knew it wasn't going to happen Wednesday, but you know, they went through the whole thing like it was going to happen and, you know, you did get excited, but then it's like, okay, well, you know, it was a good dry run.
Exactly. And it was a good dry run, I think, for us as journalists too. Cause I mean, the folks that were there, had never covered a human launch. I mean, there's only a few shuttle veterans in the reporting corps out there. You know, Peter King, Bill Harwood, they come to mind. But I was with Chibeli Carazano, who writes for the Orlando Sentinel, and her and I had never covered a human launch before. We had some CNN folks in with us. You know, none of them had done this before. So it was a good dry run that Wednesday. And I as well, we have a meteorologist for the Florida public radio stations. And he was texting me the whole day. And he's like, Bren, this isn't happening. This isn't happening today. But Saturday looked to be the same. And I was like, you know what, we're gonna have to be here again tomorrow. And I was even, you know, starting coverage plans to come out. I think the next opportunity was going to be on Tuesday, because I'm like, this isn't even happening on tomorrow, on Sunday. And then about an hour before launch, the weather started opening up. The board was green. And the weather broke, and you know how it is at the Kennedy Space Center.
Oh, yeah.
It's, you know, one minute it's a dark sky and the next it's absolutely beautiful. And that's what we got. And it was just an incredible moment to see that Falcon 9 ignite and just take off. And then, as you know, probably watching launches to, you know, 10 seconds later,
you
start to hear it, and then you start to feel it, and it cracks the air. And it was an absolutely incredible moment. And all launches are amazing, and they never get old, no matter what they are. It's just so cool to see those things light and just take off and, you know, go into the sky. But this was exceptionally incredible, and it was because just hours before then, you know, Doug gave me a thumbs up on the way to the launch pad. And I think that made it so much more different. And one thing I want to ask you, Dave, is, you know, this was something that, you know, all eyes were on this mission. I think when I looked at the stream, it was, you know, 1 million people were watching NASA TV on YouTube. As someone who, you know, kind of chronicles the Apollo era as a historian, I mean, how did this compare to some other, you know, highly watched space launches?
That's a really good question, because it was similar but different. For one thing, the rocket itself is not a Saturn V, so it's not that impressive, although it's beautiful, and you know, it's the technology of it is wonderful, and I love the Falcon 9 rocket. So, you know, it didn't have that, but it had that emotional power to it. The emotions washing over you because we, you know, if you paid any attention at all, you really did get to know Bob and Doug, the two astronaut dads, and, you know, their wives are astronauts. And you know, the heart-wrenching moment when they say goodbye and do the virtual hugs with their little kids, you know, as they leave, when you just know, it's like, you know, spaceflight's dangerous. I've seen people die on top of rockets. And you know that can happen. You know, it's dangerous. So, you know, the emotion washing over you was very much the same as back in that Apollo era. And just the excitement of, you know, knowing that we were returning to space from that same launch pad where all of those iconic missions happened, that made it, for me, resonates, you know, with me emotionally over these 50 years. So that part was also wonderful. There was something I caught, the journalists that I saw on NASA TV, they're so young, you know, they know a lot, but there's a lot they don't know. There was a moment that Bob and Doug did Saturday And I think they did it again on Wednesday, rather. And I think they did it again Saturday, where they got out of the Teslas. And, but, you know, that rocket looks a lot like, it, you know, similar to a Mercury Redstone. You know, it's got that skinny look to it with the little capsule on top, much more futuristic looking, of course. But they did an Alan Shepard, and I kind of wondered, are they going to do an Alan Shepard? And they did. They looked up at the spacecraft, they cocked their heads up, looked at the capsule, and they looked up at it, and they gave it the classic, right out of the Right Stuff movie, the thumbs up. And I saw that, that is a total salute to Alan Shepard. And, you know, those guys have seen the movie The Right Stuff, I'm sure, a bazillion times. And I caught that, but nobody else did. And it was like, what, you guys didn't know? And then one of the people on NASA TV said, oh, I think they're taking a selfie. And I just wanted to scream. I was like, no, that's not what they're doing.
Yeah, that was a great moment, because I know, like, I spoke with quite a few astronauts who knew Bob and Doug that were part of the Bug class, which was the class of astronauts selected in 2000. And Bob and Doug were part of that class. And I talked to Terry Virts, who's also a test pilot. And I was like, what do you think this moment is for Doug? You know, and he was like, man, this is what you dream of. When you become an astronaut or you become a test pilot, you live to fly these vehicles for the first time. And he gets that rare opportunity to do it. So the fact that he was, you know, giving that Alan Shepard salute goes to show you that he knows that this is an important mission for him. But it's also this highly coveted mission to be the first to fly on a spacecraft. So I'm glad you picked that up. I didn't see that because our Wi-Fi was terrible. We can send a man to the moon, but we can't give the journalists proper Wi-Fi at the Kennedy Space Center press site. So I didn't get to see much of the webcast. I had to go back and actually watch the goodbye to the kids, which I'm kind of glad I didn't see in real time, because I would have been in tears.
I cried. Think. Yeah, I did. I got choked up. Yeah, that was quite a moment. And to your point about, you know, these guys are test pilots, and for a test pilot, you want to fly a vehicle for the first time, like you said. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you a story that is similar. Let's talk about Apollo 9, which is a mission that kind of gets overlooked in the history books. It didn't go to the moon, but it's the first flight of the Saturn V with a lunar module on board and the command module, the stack that was going to go to the moon and land on the moon. So this was an Earth orbital mission. And I got to know Jim McDivitt quite well. We played golf together. And I asked him about it. I said, you know, a lot of people think about Apollo 8 as the greatest of the Apollo missions. Like that's kind of the insiders like myself. We all view Apollo 8 as just the moment of Apollo, as big as Neil Armstrong's, you know, one small step for man, because it was that first trip out away from Earth's gravity. But I asked him about it. I said, well, you know, what was your thoughts about when you found out that you were going to have this different mission? He said, you know what? Well, I had a mission where I was flying a machine for the very first time, the lunar module. That's a test pilot's dream. You know, we got to do everything for the first time. And he said, for me, it was an interesting mission, and I loved it. I'm very proud of it. You know, it set the stage for what came after. And that's, you know, that's that test pilot mentality. You want to fly the thing for the first time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I remember hearing from Terry that, you know, as you know, the SpaceX Crew Dragon is pretty autonomous, and there's very few opportunities to fly it by hand. And Terry was wondering, you know, I'm not sure if Doug's going to be able to sit back and not try to take control and fly this thing, which, you know, they both did get a chance to fly it by hand to test out the systems. But, you know, thinking of a test pilot as just a passenger is a very interesting scenario to imagine, and what was going through Doug's head, where, you know, Bob even said he was going to have to, you know, make Doug sit on his hands during some of these maneuvers just to let the computer fly. So it's very fascinating to think about that.
As exciting as the launch was, I almost enjoyed the rendezvous and docking even more. That I found that to be just fascinating to watch this orbital ballet. And what was great about it is, unlike a lot of previous missions, and especially back in the day of Apollo, where, you know, you'd have to rely on animations and things like that, you didn't really get to watch it happen in high def with really good, you know, good visuals. It was really interesting to me to see the views inside Crew Dragon, looking over Bob and Doug's shoulders at the displays, at those wonderful touch screens, and getting to understand what the touch screens were for, with the center screen, which is basically their mission objectives checklist of what they're doing, you know, a timeline as it's going by. And then on the left and right displays, you know, the attitude control kind of and systems of the spacecraft. It was really interesting to watch that, because I was just dumbstruck by, this reminds me so much of the film 2001: A Space Odyssey. And it was so much like that that I turned the sound off on NASA TV and turned it down. And I put on the Blue Danube. I put on the Blue Danube waltz, I cranked it up, and I watched that, and it just fit perfectly. Because from that film, if you're familiar with the film, there's the scene where the Pan Am Clipper space shuttle is coming into dock with that giant orbiting wheel of a space station, and they've got the Blue Danube waltz on. And you see over the pilots, the display screens, and they're kind of like touch screens, and it looks so much like that, you know, much more modern, of course, but so reminiscent of it that I thought, wow, 2001 A Space Odyssey is finally happening. It's just happening about, you know, 20, 30 years after they thought it would.
Later, yeah. Yeah, it's absolutely fascinating. Kubrick would definitely have been pretty proud of those shots that NASA and SpaceX were able to get. But I think that's such an important aspect of the mission, and being able to bring these images back to Earth and tell the story in real time is something that is just so incredible. And I know that it was something that SpaceX was thinking about early on. Like, I remember talking with, SpaceX officials about, you know, these plans for commercial crew webcast, like, years before we even were going to have a launch. And the objective was, it is so important that we show the story to the American people, because the American people own this. This is paid for by the American people, and they need to see what we're doing, and we need to give them access to it. And so I think SpaceX does an incredible job at providing just incredible visuals to help tell the story of exploration, and not only tell the story, but inspire people down here. I mean, you and I have seen countless images and videos of the International Space Station, but there is something so powerful about seeing it from the window of the Crew Dragon capsule, and seeing it just kind of come into being in the screen in this wide shot. And then as the Dragon got closer and closer, getting bigger and bigger, that docking was just absolutely incredible, and it's inspiring. And I think that's really was the goal for SpaceX and NASA for this, you know, obviously was to figure out a way to transport their astronauts up there. But I mean, this is one hell of a recruiting video to get people interested in this industry again. I mean, it gave me chills seeing that capsule arrive at the station. It was just awesome.
I'm Dave Schloem from Blue Dot.
And I'm Brendan Byrne from Are We There Yet?
And we're going to take a short break, but stay with us. We'll be right back. And we're back. I'm Dave Schloem. And he's Brendan Byrne, host of Are We There Yet? And we're talking about America's Place in Space 2020. Brendan covers the spaceflight beat from Florida's Space Coast at WMFE in Orlando, Florida. We joined forces to share our mutual interests and experiences with the U.S. space program. Well, we would be remiss, I think, as journalists and storytellers to ignore what was happening as a backdrop to all this, you know, unfortunately, on Earth, was, you know, all of the protests going on. And, you know, one of the things that, you know, I've gotten to know from a lot of my Black friends, and some of them people like that, you know, in very, you know, high-tech jobs, scientists, is that, you know, unlike myself, I never had to have the quote-unquote talk with my son about what it's like to interact with the police. It doesn't matter if you're Charles Bolden or Leland Melvin or Gregory Robinson, you have to have that talk. So we've had that whole dynamic playing out behind it. I just wondered what your thoughts were, you know, kind of juxtaposing all this.
Yeah, it was very interesting to think about it in the historical context, and, you know, where will this sit in the chapters of history? And those journalists who asked those questions, they got a lot of flack from some of the folks in the space community for, you know, why are you even asking that? But it's very important. I mean, this is a journey of human beings, and, you know, everyone is involved with what's happening. So I'm glad they asked that, and I'm glad that the astronauts reflected on it. I had a chance to chat with Charlie Bolden before the launch, but also before the protests started happening. So we didn't specifically talk about the protests, but he spoke to me and he said one of the most exciting things about the Commercial Crew Program is how it's opening up access to space. You know, with Mercury, Gemini, Apollo, there were just a certain group of people that could go to space. You know, at most you could get three up there. The shuttle was supposed to change that by bringing more people in different perspectives up to space. And he said, you know, if it wasn't for shuttle, he, a Black man, wouldn't have gone to space. That's the only way that he could have been there is to have the ability to send seven people where they were able to get a diverse crew up into orbit. And he says that, you know, that's what Commercial Crew is going to be able to do. You know, NASA has seats booked, but SpaceX can put more people on there. There's other companies out there trying to get more and more people into space. And Dave, I'm sure you're aware of, you know, the great philosophy of the overview effect and how, you know, the more that people see this world from that perspective that astronauts see, it changes them spiritually. And, you know, some folks out there say that this might help, you know, humanity. If more and more people can get a different perspective on our world, things will be greatly different down here. Now, that doesn't mean that we just need to send people to space and all of our problems are going to go away, but it's still a fascinating thing to think about that, you know, we all do need to kind of look at this as we all are on this planet together. We're stuck here together, and we really need to live better with each other, and we can do that by taking a brand new perspective on how we see our world.
Well, for some of our listeners who may not quite understand what the overview effect is, there's even beyond that, there's what I call the cosmic perspective, which that is part of, is that there are people who just, they live their entire lives out on this world thinking that it's this very big place. And then there are people who have a sense by looking at images, perhaps, or if they're very fortunate being astronauts, and especially the Apollo astronauts who got to see what the Earth looks like when you can cover it up with your thumb held at arm's length, that you do get a sense of how fragile, you know, a world it is. But even being in Earth orbit from in the ISS, which is not, you know, it's really not that far away. People get a sense of, oh, it's just so far away. They're out in space. Well, it's, you know, it's about as far as from here to San Francisco for me. It's not that it's far. It's that it's above and it's traveling very fast. But you do, you know, you fly over the Earth and they all pretty much say the same thing. You don't see lines on the ground. You don't see borders. You see one Earth, and you realize when you're up there with perhaps a Russian cosmonaut and you're having dinner together, you fly over each other's, you know, hometowns. And, you know, a lot of those political nationalistic differences that are driving politics in such an evil direction, I think, nowadays, you know, those things melt away when you look at the Earth in that, from that perspective. That's why my show is called Blue Dot. It's named after the famous essay by Carl Sagan, Pale Blue Dot, of the Voyager image of the Earth taken from the outer solar system as it left the planetary part of the solar system. And the beautiful Cassini image of the Earth as a tiny blue dot set against the rings of Saturn. As you realize, you know, that this is a tiny, tiny place, and it's so fragile. The more the perspective on that you have, the more you tend to care about, you know, the big picture and taking care of this planet. Almost all of the astronauts that I've ever talked to from the Apollo era come back changed in that sense, that they cherish the environment of the Earth a lot more than they did before they went.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And I think that, you know, the opportunity for more and more people to experience that, I mean, we're just on the cusp. You know, you look at these space tourism providers that are coming online, like Blue Origin, Virgin Galactic, even just today that we tape this show, a new company called Space Perspective wants to take people on a hydrogen-filled balloon to the edge of space, into the stratosphere, and give them these 360 views of the Earth and the inky black cosmos. We're going to have more and more chances for people to get that to get that overview effect and to feel those things that you just described. So it is exciting to see that is the direction we're moving in. Now, I mean, it's still not available to everyone. I mean, we're talking about $250,000 to, you know, do something like this, but we're getting there. And I think it's a very interesting future.
Well, I think it's a very exciting future, especially for somebody like you and where you are and what you're doing right now, because it seems to me that this is going to open up low Earth orbit, you know, to a lot of different kinds of enterprises and start to open up, you know, space exploration to where there will be a lot more people involved in it. And the idea of, you know, going to work in space on a space station manufacturing things is now, you know, not so far-fetched as it seemed maybe just even a few years ago. And to get on my soapbox and preach the gospel of space exploration a little bit for our economy is that one of the things that's really bothered me about the United States that I grew up in compared to now, and there were good things and bad things back then, just like 1968 was a horrible year with race riots and you know, the death of Martin Luther King was just horrible. And then Robert Kennedy right afterwards. And 1968, in a way, seems to mirror this year in some ways. But the United States was a manufacturing country. We made things. We built things. We did things. And then we turned into this service economy. And this pandemic, I think, has really shown the weakness of the American economy being so dependent on service jobs. Whereas these jobs in the space industry, they are high-quality jobs. You're doing manufacturing. We're making things. And as you know, when you have these kinds of jobs, when you do this kind of work, all of this stuff spins off into the economy and generates many more dollars out into the economy.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, we're seeing that here in the Space Coast. And you know, these commercial companies, we're in a new commercial boom here, and it's really driving the economy. I took a deep dive this week into, you know, how the space industry is faring through the coronavirus pandemic, and it turns out not bad. Launches are still happening. I mean, we saw the launch of Bob and Doug on DM2 happen during this. They're still investing in space companies because, I mean, there's inherent risk in investing in space, and this is just one aspect of that risk. But yeah, there's so much work going on here in this industry that it really is, it's driving the local economy here, and you're starting to see it drive economies elsewhere that are becoming these you know, these aerospace hotspots throughout the country. It's just incredible. I mean, as someone who you know, has followed this for as long as you have, I mean, did you foresee this kind of pivot to commercial space like it is now?
No, not recently. As a kid, I thought that would be happening. You know, that was the vision of the future I had, and then that kind of went away. Where I was like, okay, well, we just have the space shuttle, and we're going to build a space station, and you know, we're never really going anywhere, and it's just not that exciting compared to going to the moon. And now it seems exciting again. And let's talk about Project Artemis. I'd like to get your take on that.
Mm-hmm. It is very, very cool. I have kind of followed this one since, as I mentioned, you know, my first story I covered for WMFE as a space reporter was the launch of the one of the Orion capsules, the Operation Flight Test. It wasn't the actual capsule. It was a dummy capsule, but it was still really cool to see that launch. And so Artemis is NASA's new moonshot, which they're hoping to do by 2024. That is a very ambitious goal.
Think they'll meet it?
No. No, I think they'll get close, but I don't know if they'll meet 2024. There's still a lot that needs to happen. And coronavirus actually has had an impact on this program. So the core stage of the SLS, the Space Launch System rocket, that will launch the first Artemis 1, which is an uncrewed mission around the moon, it's undergoing testing at the Marshall Space Flight Center, which they had to limit staff and employees there. So they're kind of running a little behind on doing that. And then we can imagine there might be some kinks or hiccups they discover doing the testing there. But it's progressing, and it'll be super exciting to see because it's happening here. It's happening here in Florida, in my backyard, from Launch Complex 39B, which, you know, has a very special place in human space exploration history. So to kind of see that pad take shape and get ready for this new super rocket is going to be really cool. I don't know if they're going to make the deadlines, but I'm very excited to see it launch once it does, because I've never seen something that big launch. I mean, we're talking Saturn V level power coming off that launch pad. And man, that is going to be so cool to see.
Well, I'll tell you what, the shock, when you do, the shock waves from that, you'll feel it. It's like being at a really good rock concert with a really fantastic guy with bass pedals. You'll feel it as much as you hear it. Thanks to my new good friend and guest, Brendan Byrne. While we cover a wide array of topics here on Blue Dot, if you're really interested in keeping track of what's going on at America's iconic spaceport, the Kennedy Space Center, I recommend you subscribe to Brendan's podcast, Are We There Yet?, from WMFE in Orlando, Florida. A link to the show will be in this program's description. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. We are distributed by PRX, and if you missed an episode or want to share one, check out our archives at mynspr.org. Subscribe to our podcast via the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. Our associate producer and owner of A Dog Named Rocket is Ellie Johnson. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.